And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's March the 6th, 65th day of the year. Only 300 days remain till the year's over with. And, let's see, holidays observances, which is something y'all asked me to do. It's National Dress Day. Put on a dress today. From puffy sleeves to V-necks, from halter tops to hoop skirts. Dresses have been in all shapes and sizes. National Oreo Cookie Day. Interesting thing that was pointed out to me by my wife. Recent studies show that Oreo cookies, 12 a day, do as good as statin drugs. Now, tell that to your doctor. National White Chocolate Cheesecake Day. National Frozen Food Day. Hospitality Workers and Healthcare Day. National Dentist Day. National Salt Awareness Week. Butcher's Week. Teen Tech Week. Oop. My monitor just fell over. Words Matter Week. National Invest in Veterans Week. Schooled Breakfast Week. Returned Borrowed Books Week. Read an e-book week. National School Social Work Week. Dental Assistant Recognition Week. I'd recognize mine anywhere. National Consumer Protection Week. National Professional Pet Sitters Week. Now that's a job to aspire to. Cheerleading Week. Well Eisner Week. Write a Letter Appreciation Week. Universal Human Beings Week. British Pie Week. Telecommuter Appreciation Week. No More Week. Women in Construction Week. National Procrastination Week. Birth dates on this day is Tyler the Creator and Shaquille O'Neal. The Great Daffodil Appeal. National Reading Month. Veggie Month. National Sauce Month. National Peanut Month. National Colon Cancer Awareness Month. Epilepsy Awareness Month. Developmental Disability Awareness Month. Brain Tumor Awareness Month. National Women's History Month. National Nutrition Month. National Hemophilia Awareness Month. National Social Work Month. National Small Press Month. Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month. National Caffeine Awareness Month. National Umbrella Month. National Kidney Month. National Craft Month. International Ideas Month. National Credit Education Month. National Cheerleading Safety Month. Endometriosis Awareness Month. Rising Star Month. National Music in Our Schools Month, Irish American History Month, and National Athletic Training Month. All that having been said, 12 BC, the Roman Emperor Augustus is named Pontifex Maximus, incorporating the position into that of the emperor. 632 AD, the farewell sermon of the Islamic prophet Muhammad took place on this date. 845 A.D., the 42 martyrs of Amorium are killed after refusing to convert to Islam. 961, Byzantine conquest of Shandex by Nikephoros Phokas, end of the Emirate of Crete. 1204, the siege of Chateau Galliard ends in a French victory over King John of England, who loses control of Normandy to King Philip II Augustus. 1323, the Treaty of Paris of 1323 is signed. 1454, 13 Years' War. Delegates of the Prussian Confederation pledge allegiance to King Casimir IV of Poland, agrees to commit his forces in aiding the Confederation's struggle for independence from the Teutonic Knights. Teutonic Knights were the German version of the Knights Templar, for those that are not familiar. 1521, Ferdinand Magellan arrives in Guam. 1665, the first joint secretary of the Royal Society, Henry Oldenburg, publishes the first issues of Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, the world's longest-running scientific journal. 1788, the first fleet arrives at Norfolk Island in order to found a convict settlement. 1820, the Missouri Compromise is signed into law by President James Monroe. Compromise allows Missouri to enter the Union as a slave state, brings Maine into the Union as a free state, and makes the rest of the northern part of the Louisiana Purchase territory slavery free. 1834, York, Upper Canada, is incorporated as Toronto. 1836, Texas Revolution, Battle of the Alamo. After a 13-day siege by an army of 3,000 Mexican troops, 187 Texas volunteers, including frontiersman Davy Crockett and Colonel Jim Bowie, defending the Alamo, are killed and the fort's captured. There are a number of different versions of how Davy Crockett died. Some say he was actually just finally overwhelmed and stood up against a wall and shot. We'll probably never know. 1857, the Supreme Court of the U.S. rules 7-2 in the Dred Scott v. Sanford case that the Constitution does not confer citizenship on black people. Interesting. 1869, Dmitry Mendeleev presents the first periodic table to the Russian Chemical Society. 1882, the Serbian Kingdom is refounded. 1899, Bayer registers aspirin as a trademark. 1901, anarchist assassin tries to kill German Emperor Wilhelm II. 1904, Scottish National Antarctic Expedition, led by William Spears Bruce, the Antarctic region of Coatesland was discovered from the Scotia. 1912, the Italo-Turkish War. Italian forces become the first to use airships in war. As two dirigibles drop bombs on Turkish troops encamped at Janzur from an altitude of 1,800 meters. 1930, International Unemployment Day. Demonstrations globally initiated by the Comintern. 1933, Great Depression. President Franklin D. Roosevelt declares a bank holiday, closes all U.S. banks, and freezes all financial transactions. That's like something our fearless leader would do today. 1943, Norman Rockwell publishes Freedom from Want in the Saturday Evening Post with a matching essay by Carlos Pelosan as part of the Four Freedoms series. 1943, World War II. General Field Marshal Erwin Rommel launches the Battle of Madinien in an attempt to slow down the British 8th Army. It fails, and Rommel leaves Africa 3 days later. 1943, World War II. The Battle of Fardikambos, one of the first major battles between the Greek resistance and the occupying Royal Italian Army, ends with the surrender of an entire Italian battalion. Bulk of the garrison of the town of Grenvina, leading to its liberation over only a fortnight later. 1944, World War II. Soviet Air Force's bomb and evacuated town of Narva in a German-occupied Estonia destroyed the entire historical Swedish-era town. 1945, World War II. Cologne is captured by American troops. On that same day, Operation Spring Awakening, the last major German offensive of the war, begins. 1946, Ho Chi Minh signs an agreement with France that recognizes Vietnam as an autonomous state in the Indo-Chinese Federation and the French Union. It's interesting. Ho Chi Minh went from being a loyal French citizen to hating everything it stood for. Cold War. The trial of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg begins on this date. 1953, Grigory Malenkov succeeds Joseph Stalin as Premier of the Soviet Union and First Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. 1957, Ghana becomes the first sub-Saharan country to gain independence from the British. 1964, Nation of Islam leader Elijah Muhammad officially gives boxing champion Cassius Clay the name Muhammad Ali. 1964, Constantine II becomes the last king of Greece. 1965, Premier Tom Playford of South Australia loses power after 27 years in office. 1967, Cold War. Joseph Stalin's daughter Svetlana Aliyeva defects to the United States. 1968, three rebels executed by Rhodesia, the first execution since UDI, prompting international condemnation. UDI was Rhodesia's unilateral declaration of independence. They were a British protectorate, and they just said, nope, we're done. 1970, an explosion at the Weather Underground safe house in Greenwich Village kills three. 1975, for the first time, the Zapruder film of the assassination of John Kennedy is shown in motion to a national TV audience by Robert Golden and Dick Gregory. That film had been bought from Zapruder by either Life or Look magazine and locked up for over 10 years. 1975, Algiers Accord, Iran and Iraq announced a settlement of their border dispute. 1984, in the UK, a walkout at Cortonwood Colliery in Brampton Barlow signals the start of a strike that lasts almost a year and involved the majority of the country's miners. 1987, the British ferry MS Herald of Free Enterprise capsizes in about 90 seconds, killing 193. 1988, the three provisional Irish Republican Army volunteers are shot dead by the SAS in Gibraltar in Operation Flavius. 1992, the Michelangelo computer virus begins to affect computers. For those who are not familiar with it, it was first discovered February 4, 1991 in Australia. The virus was designed to infect DOS systems, but didn't engage the operating system or make any OS calls. Like all boot sector viruses, it operated at the BIOS level. Each year, the virus remained dormant until March 6th, the birthday of Renaissance artist Michelangelo. There's no reference to the artist in the virus, and it's doubtful the virus's developer intended a connection between the virus and the artist. The name was chosen by researchers who noticed the coincidence of the activation date. The actual significance of the date to the author is not known, and Michelangelo is a variant of the old-late endemic stoned virus. You know, the people who put their abilities into creating these viruses should have all been shot. 2003, Air Algiers Flight 6289 crashes at the Aguinar Haj Bay Ahomok Airport in Tamanrasset, Algeria, killing 102 of the 103 on board. 2008, a suicide bomber kills 68, including first responders in Baghdad on the same day that a gunman kills eight students in Jerusalem. 2018, Forbes names Jeff Bezos as the world's richest person for the first time. He was worth $112 billion net. And in 2020, 32 people were killed and 81 are injured when gunmen opened fire on a ceremony in Kabul, Afghanistan. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for that attack. Well, I got an email wanting me to give some more detail about the murder of Thelma Todd. Now, she was one of the most prominent comedic actresses in film in the late 20s and early 30s. Best remembered for her roles in the Marx Brothers' Monkey Business and Horse Feathers, and a number of Charlie Chase's short comedies and even some Laurel and Hardy films. She was 29 when she died. It was the morning of December 16, 1935. Found dead in her car inside the garage of silent film actress Jill Carmen. Now, Todd had been romantically linked with Carmen's husband, director Roland West. You know, Hollywood in those days, even today, is a lot of musical beds. The death was initially ruled an accident, and then later that this determination was changed to suicide. She was killed by carbon monoxide poisoning. But a lot of folks believe it was actually foul play. Todd had a broken nose and blood on her face and on her dress. Roland Lest and mobster Lucky Luciano were questioned, but there were no arrests made, and her death has been a mystery ever since. It would be nice to get a true determination of what happened to these people. Now, her full name was Thelma Alice Todd. Born in Massachusetts in 1906. Won a beauty pageant and discovered and signed with Paramount. And off she went to Hollywood. She was an incredibly talented actress, and Hollywood took advantage of that. She appeared in over 120 movies, is best known for her roles alongside the Marx Brothers and Buster Keaton. Let's give her the nickname, the Ice Cream Blonde and Hot Toddy. 1932, she wrote with American film producer Pat DiCicco. They were said to have a very abusive and tumultuous relationship. Now, as I said, she was found dead in 1935, December 16th to be exact. She ended up in the hospital after one of her drunken brawls with her husband. They got divorced in 34, and she decided to open a beachside cafe along the Pacific Coast Highway. It's called Thelma Todd Sidewalk Cafe, and it was a magnificent success, catering to the entertainment and underworld crowds. Bought the property with a boyfriend, director Roland West, and they lived above the cafe in adjoining bedrooms, and it doubled as their home. Well, on Saturday, December 14th, that was the day before her death, she and Roland had been fighting, and she decided to go to a party being held at the Cafe Trocadero. It was said that was the Trocadero was controlled by Bugsy Siegel and his group. Thelma was the guest of honor, and for the vast majority of the night, seemed to be having a wonderful time. And then she saw her ex-husband, Pat DiCicco, with his new girlfriend. Todd felt embarrassed and humiliated, and a fight broke out. And she got drunk and confided in her friend, Ida, she'd been seeing a rich businessman. Well, Thelma left the Trocadero at about 3 in the morning. Roland West didn't go to the party and told Thelma to be home by 2. She arrived at the party about 8 p.m., and at 1 a.m., I asked Sid Grauman to call West and let him know she'd be leaving soon. But she didn't leave the party till 3 in the morning. Last person to see her alive was a driver dropped off after the party. She wasn't allowed to drive due to getting in multiple car accidents. The chauffeur that drove her home that night said Todd was unusually quiet and told him not to escort her to the door as he usually did. Well, people have claimed to have seen her the morning after the party, and a close friend of Todd claimed to have gotten a phone call from her explaining the events of the previous night. The problem is, according to the autopsy, she would have already been dead at the time of that phone call. It wasn't until the following Monday morning, about 10:30 in the morning, the maid found Thelma, slumped over the wheel of her 32 Lincoln Phaeton. Her death was ruled as a suicide immediately, even though those close to her said she'd never do that. Most disturbing thing was how the paparazzi were able to get close-up shots of her dead body to put in magazines and newspapers. Well, the coroner determined that she had died between 5 and 8 a.m. on Sunday of carbon monoxide poisoning. The car was still running, but out of gas when she was discovered. Also still wearing her party clothes from Saturday night, though she had peas and carrots in her stomach, which weren't served at the Trocadero. Another piece of compelling evidence is that the night of the party was very windy, so her hair should have been disheveled, but it was perfectly styled. And the walk from where she was dropped off to where she was found is a long walk. If she had indeed walked to the garage from the spot where a driver dropped her off, it had been quite a hike. For her to get to the garage, she'd had to climb over 270 stairs or walk through some dark streets through a very hilly area. Her shoes would definitely have been dirty or damaged from the walk, but the wear and tear on her shoes were not consistent. Her feet were clean and her stockings were not damaged, so she certainly didn't try walking without her shoes. Now, there are a number of people that started to get suspicious and wonder if she even made the walk, or maybe somebody put her there. Then it was discovered she had a broken nose. People had a theory. Maybe she got locked out and went into her car to keep warm till morning. But it's questionable whether or not she was even locked out because her key was in her handbag. I mean, frankly, this could all have been a tragic accident. There were also reports she suffered a stroke or a heart attack, which would have led to her death of natural causes, but the evidence didn't support that. And even though suicide would be a very easy explanation, it was difficult for anybody to believe. According to her friends, all her behavior indicated she was looking forward to the future and expanding her cafe. And when she was found, her car was full of Christmas gifts to friends and family. No suicide note. And she had that broken nose, which is very hard to inflict on yourself. Leads you to believe that she was murdered, but if she was, who did it? Well, if her death wasn't accidental or a suicide, that's either murder or natural causes. And the number one suspect, of course, was her ex-husband, Pat DiCicco. Rumors and inconsistent facts arose very quickly, and people pointed fingers. Pat was a producer, but he was also a mobster and closely affiliated with Lucky Luciano, the famous gangster. They wanted to start an illegal gambling parlor on the third floor of Thelma's Cafe, and she refused them multiple times, and they just weren't used to people saying no. Lucky Luciano had had a previous romantic relationship with Thelma, but it was said he was abusive toward her. And many of her friends had reason to believe Roland West had ties to the mafia, that he was more receptive to the idea of letting gangsters run a illegal gambling racket in the restaurant. Some theories even suggest that Roland and some gangsters are waiting for her to come home so they could settle the casino matter once and for all. Well, if DeMott was involved, it might explain why some people close to Thelma and Roland were unwilling to publicly speak out about what happened. That the strange and questionable arrangement was also in play. Thelma Todd lived with Roland because he was her boyfriend, but there was actually a third person who lived with him, Jewel Carmen, Roland West's wife. It was suspected she might have gotten jealous and killed Thelma. Well, Roland West's deathbed, he admitted to being involved in her death, but his version had some definite inconsistencies. Well, she was a legend, no question about it. She died too early, buried at Bellevue Cemetery in Lawrence, Massachusetts. She was an old Hollywood legend and immortalized with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. It's sad when folks like that die. There's actually some other information that came from the Los Angeles Magazine, December 1987 issue. You know, dark strangers and the suicide and a jealous boyfriend and the mob all have been fingered at one time or another for Thelma Todd's death. Well, according to the information that appeared in Los Angeles Magazine, Mae Whitehead, who worked for Thelma, had some things to say. She'd pulled up alongside the cliff wall high on Positano Road above Will Rogers Beach. And she walked to the garage, carrying several things in her arms. The doors were closed, but they weren't locked. Well, Whitehead juggled what she was carrying to free one hand and slid back the right-hand door, and she could see the grill and headlamps of the chocolate-colored 1933 Lincoln Phaeton that belonged to Thelma Todd. 10:30 on the cold and sunny morning, December 16th, 1935. Whitehead was out of the garage and leave her own car in its place, and then drive the steep meandering lanes to a white stucco building at the bottom of the hill on what's now Pacific Coast Highway. This rambling Mediterranean three-story building housed Thelma Todd's Sidewalk Cafe, a very pricey, popular restaurant operated by Todd's partner and lover, film director Roland West. On this particular morning, she approached the Lincoln from the passenger side, and then she saw Todd slumped behind the wheel, her eyes closed, her head inclined toward the car's open door. Wearing a full-length mink coat over a metallic blue sequin evening gown and a matching cape, blue silk slippers, and about $20,000 worth of jewelry, including a square-cut diamond ring, a diamond-studded wristwatch, pin and brooch, and two diamond hair clasps. That was the same outfit Whitehead had helped her put on to attend a celebrity-studded dinner party at the Sunset Strip's trendy Trocadero nightclub the previous Saturday evening. Whitehead told the coroner's jury, "I went around to the left side of the car, the driver's side, and I thought I could wake her up, but that she was just asleep." But it was discovered Thelma Todd was dead. Whitehead leaned back to her car and drove to the cafe where she got hold of Charles Smith, the septuagenarian cafe treasurer and veteran assistant film director who'd served Roland West for decades. West, who was 48, a little shorter than Todd's 5'4". He and Todd lived in modest second-floor apartments connected to an outward show of propriety. West was still married to silent film star Jewel Carmen, but they could slide the doors open, and they could also be locked from either side. And adjacent to the apartment was a private club. Joy, isn't it? Oversized lobby with couches where what we euphemistically describe as overtired guests sometimes napped. Well, Smith buzzed West, who was upstairs and apparently still asleep. Buzzed him on the intercom. West appeared minutes, carelessly dressed, and jumped into Whitehead's car. And in her excitement on the way back to the garage, Whitehead missed a turnoff and had to stop and turn the car around on a narrow lane. At the garage, West raced inside and put a hand on Todd's face. Pulled his hand back, and there was blood on it, which he wiped on his handkerchief. West told Whitehead to fetch Rudolph Schaefer, the cafe manager and his brother-in-law. Schaefer lived in Castillo del Mar, an enormous hillside villa owned by West's estranged wife that overlooked West and Todd's place. Schaefer had also been asleep, got to the garage about 11:15. He touched Todd's cold cheek and confirmed that she was dead and said the police had to be called, and West agreed. Electing not to use the phones at the sidewalk cafe or those at Castillo del Mar, Schaefer took West to Hubmobile, parked as usual in the stall next to Todd's Lincoln, and drove several miles to a Santa Monica print shop where he called the LAPD's West Los Angeles station on the proprietor's private phone. Now that raises interesting questions in and of itself. At the death scene, police said they didn't see any signs of violence. 2.5 gallons of gas left in the Lincoln's tank. Ignition was on, but the battery was flat. On the seat was Todd's small white party purse, and inside was the key to her apartment's outside door. Well, with this investigation began one of the strangest chapters in the history of Los Angeles crime. Immediately, the 29-year-old actress's death made page-one headlines across the country. And as the investigation went on, the local papers were filled for months with speculation, rumor, and charges, most of them unfounded and inaccurate. Made the case one of Hollywood's most sensational unsolved mysteries. Over the years, scores of articles and books have been written hypothesizing what really happened to Thelma Todd that night. But despite more than 50 years of speculation and hype, the final chapter of her mysterious death has remained unwritten until this article was released. This is said to be the true story of what happened that night while Hollywood conspired to keep it a secret for half a century. Well, Thelma Todd was born in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Her father was an important local figure, a merchant and perennial alderman. 15, she went to work in a dime store, but when crowds of people, mostly young men, jammed the store just to look at her, the proprietor had to fire her. Lawrence Elks Club proclaimed her Miss Lawrence and sponsored her in a statewide competition in which she became Miss Massachusetts. To earn extra money during high school, she modeled clothing in a local theater. Impressed Napoleon Damara, manager and principal performer for a community theatrical troupe, he sent her a picture to Jesse Lasky at Paramount, and Lasky liked what he saw. Studio press agents later described her as a former school teacher, but despite being elected freshman class spokesman, she dropped out of Hood Normal, a teacher's college, after 1 year to attend Paramount's training school in Astoria, Long Island. Gradually, with the class of 1926 that included notables such as Buddy Rogers and Josephine Dunn, Todd's first film was God Gave Me 20 Cents. Paramount liked her way with fine clothes and her forceful, intelligent looks. Put her in 13 silent films, easily making a transition to talkies in 1927. Had a vibrant, cultured speaking voice and strove to enhance it with voice lessons. By the late 20s, her private life was being shaped by her sudden affluence in Hollywood's fast hedonistic society. July 1932, she eloped with Pasquale, or Pat, DeCiso, an agent to Prescott, Arizona. And she was already accustomed to the fast lane. She had affairs with actor Ronald Coleman, band leader Abe Lyman, and several other men before divorcing DeCiso in March of 1934. And she acquired faster and faster cars, drank to excess, cited for speeding and for driving under the influence. January 23rd, 1933, she ran into a palm tree near Hollywood Boulevard and Nicholas Canyon, suffered 3 broken ribs, a shattered collarbone, and internal injuries. And then she contracted peritonitis and hovered on the brink of death before rallying. When Hal Roach Studio forbid her to drive, she began taking Whitehead along to drive and hired Ernest Peters as her party chauffeur. Todd's career had taken a few turns when she met Roland West in 1930. The director changed her screen name to Allison Lloyd so that no taint of comedy would cling to her skirts, and started as a jaded, manipulative, pleasure-seeking debutante opposite good friend Chester Morris in Corsair. And old Todd would later appear in other dramas with such superstars as Humphrey Bogart and Randolph Scott and Gary Cooper. Went back to being Thelma Todd after producer Hal Roach half-seriously threatened to change her name to Susie Dinkleberry so that no taint of drama would cling to her skirts. Roach knew that Depression-era audiences wanted to laugh, and nobody in skirts was funnier than Todd, who went on to star in such comedy classics as Horse Feathers and Monkey Business with the Marx Brothers. But Corsair was actually West's last film, and before it was finished, he and Todd began their affair. And although he strenuously denied a relationship with Todd, it was to last off and on for 5 years until she died. Well, from the beginning, the investigation generated controversy and conflicting reports. For weeks after her death, the city's dailies ran stories recounting purported details of her last hours. First mystery confronted by the police was why Todd hadn't slept in her apartment. She'd been driven from the Trocadero and dropped off at the entrance to the cafe by her chauffeur at 4 in the morning. Hadn't taken the keys to the ground floor entrance or to the inside entrance to her apartment, but she carried one of the outside entrance to her apartment. So how was it, the coroner wanted to know, that she didn't use it? Well, West told the coroner, not realizing Todd wasn't carrying her other keys, he'd bolted the outside door from the inside because of recent prowlers and death threats against Todd. And he went to bed at 2:30 in the morning. But about 3:30, he said he was wakened by the whining of his bull terrier, White King. Dog would have barked if anybody except he or Todd were nearby, according to West, so he assumed Todd had come back. And later, hearing an electric water pump, he concluded she was taking a bath. Well, he woke up Sunday morning to find Todd gone, and judging by an impression left on a lobby divan, West said he assumed she had slept there, rising early to depart, maybe to visit her mother in Hollywood. Well, police eventually advanced the theory. Todd, finding herself locked out, decided to sleep in her car and climbed the 271 steps cut into the steep cliff behind the cafe to the garage. And it was a very cold and windy night, and she might have started the engine to keep warm. And since the autopsy revealed a blood alcohol content of 0.8, it's considered a legal threshold of intoxication today. She might have dozed off before being overcome by the engine's fumes, but that theory was immediately brought under attack. Todd hated to walk, according to West. She had a heart condition. Her physician forbid her strenuous exercise. Though the autopsy indicated no heart or other organ abnormalities, West claimed Todd was subject to frequent fainting spells because of her heart condition. And nobody asked, at least publicly, why Todd would have chosen to sit freezing in her open-top phaeton when West's unlocked Hubmobile sedan was right next to it. Well, the press immediately seemed intent on discrediting the police investigation. Several papers dug up stories with remarkable testimony of people who claimed to have seen or spoken with Todd well after the time of death fixed by the coroner, anywhere from 5 to 6 o'clock on up to 8 o'clock on Sunday morning. Hearst LA Examiner read a page-wide headshot of autopsy surgeon A.F. Wagner over the headline, "I don't believe she could have died early in 5 or 6 last Sunday afternoon." Totally inaccurate, it served to heighten the mystery of Todd's last hours. Well, despite the inquest testimony of early PD Captain Bruce Clark, the first cop on the scene, that the bottoms of Todd's slippers were scuffed up quite a bit and gave the appearance or indication she'd walked quite a distance on cement, it was why the reporter whose slippers showed no signs she could have climbed the 271 steps, the most direct route between the cafe and the garage. So much play was given to this bit of disinformation. In fact, LAPD had a 120-pound woman the same weight as Todd climbed the stone steps in similar slippers, to the delight of the press, who witnessed the test but all but ignored the results, which confirmed the inquest testimony. Well, some news reports described a tooth knocked out of Todd's mouth. Others turned those few specks of blood found on Todd's lip to a fountain of gore. One police beat reporter wrote about the great bruises inside Todd's throat, suggesting it be made by a Coke bottle. Well, in reality, there was no broken tooth or any bruises, and the tiny bit of blood from her lip was consistent with postmortem changes in mucous membranes, typical of carbon monoxide poisoning. Facts contained in the coroner's report, but never publicized. There was one possible witness, a night watchman named Earl Carter. Carter, who by his own calculations walked past the death scene 15 times between midnight and dawn. That's an average of once every 24 minutes. But Carter, tall, burly, employed by West, said he neither saw nor heard anything unusual. Had he done that, he would have heard the engine running. As the investigators continued, rumors of foul play took on a new slant. Todd's hired driver, Ernest Peters, testified to dropping her off at the sidewalk cafe just before 4 o'clock on Sunday morning. Oddly, for the first time in 3 years Peters worked for her, Todd declined his offer to escort her to the outside door of her apartment. He testified she had said absolutely nothing on the ride home. Nevertheless, reporters were soon quoting him as saying that after leaving the night, quoting him as saying that after leaving the nightclub, Todd insisted he drive fast because she feared being killed or kidnapped by gangsters. Then two men who worked in a Christmas tree lot in Hollywood came forward to report seeing Todd and a dark stranger at around midnight Sunday. Adding several days later, two burly gunmen in a long black car subsequently warned them against telling police what they'd seen. Soon anonymous officials were leaking stories about a supposed mafia connection. It was alleged that Lucky Luciano's mob, attracted by the sidewalk cafe's semi-remote location and wealthy clientele, wanted to open an illegal casino on the third floor, and when Todd opposed it, she was murdered. Well, the press also made a lot about Todd's Trocadero attendance and the company such luminaries as Sid Grauman and British director Stanley Lupino, his daughter Ida, and starlet Margaret Lindsay, who arrived on the arm of Pat DiCicco, who Todd had divorced nearly 2 years before. DiCicco was attending another party there, but the dailies made much of the couple's inevitable meeting, insinuating he sought to embarrass his ex-wife by bringing along another woman. It was irrelevant, but certainly it was titillating. The press weren't the only ones who had doubts about the Todd case. Grand juries weren't persuaded by the collectively incredible testimony from the parade of celebrities who went out of their way to contradict each other. West, for instance, insisted if Todd had attempted to start a car, it would awaken Smith, who lived in rooms above the garage. He insisted that the Lincoln's 12-cylinder engine was loud and pointed out that there was a large hole in the garage's plaster ceiling. This assertion got a lot of newspaper ink. In a reenactment, the hole proved smallish and far from the upstairs bedroom. Police who were there listening for an engine noise heard nothing. Jewel Carmen, West's wife, testified seeing Todd, dressed quite differently from the way her body was found, driving her car with a dark, mysterious man beside her on Sunday evening. Carmen adroitly avoided cross-examination by collapsing on the witness stand. Though she later was sufficiently covered to give Luella Parsons an exclusive interview, confirming West's contention that he and Todd were merely friends. And to further compound the matter, despite Whitehead's testimony, Todd detesting using telephones get somebody else to make her calls. Two witnesses, a middle-aged male liquor store owner and a wooded druggist, wrote that Todd had used a payphone in a respective establishment Sunday afternoon and Sunday evening. And even more astounding, Mr. Wallace Ford, wife of the noted actor, insisted that Todd had telephoned her Sunday afternoon to confirm an invitation to the Ford's cocktail party. Well, one juror said several witnesses haven't told all they know, and it wasn't long before some began to suspect a cover-up. And some of those who appear most mute, most dumb, apparently are deliberately concealing facts, according to grand jury foreman George Rochester. Potent Hollywood interests have attempted to block the probe into Todd's death from the beginning, he said, warning witnesses about perjury, and likewise prosecutors smell something rotten. According to Deputy D.A. George Johnson, falsehoods have been told by certain witnesses inside the grand jury room. Somebody's covering up something. Someone we think knows how Thelma Todd died. None of the apparent facts smooth out. One reporter asked Rochester, as pressure from some influential source been brought to bear in an attempt to halt this investigation? Well, Rochester said, we're not stopping. But the witnesses stuck to their stories. In the end, the grand jury did stop. Well, Todd's death was left as an accident. That closed the case officially, but it didn't solve it. As it turns out, someone in the police department knew very well who killed Thelma Todd and why. They kept their silence but closed the file only after the killer died in 1951. Still, the real story couldn't be told. A handful of powerful Hollywood insiders with long memories and wide connections maintained a conspiracy of silence. Even after the architect of the conspiracy died in 1961, associates continued to suppress the story. Over the years, whenever a film studio expressed an interest in the mystery of Todd's death, somebody always intervened and the idea was quietly dropped. Well, to understand exactly what happened, it's necessary to understand a little about the times and the principles involved. The Todd affair is particularly sensitive to L.A. film, business and civic leaders of the day, because on the very day her body was found, Warner Brothers director Busby Berkeley went on trial for three counts of second-degree murder for his alcohol-related head-on collision with another car on a Pacific Coast highway, which was not far from Todd's Cafe. If there's one thing the L.A. establishment didn't want, it was another showboat murder trial involving alcohol and a noted director. Now an almost forgotten figure, Roland West was at the time one of the most innovative directors in Hollywood, pioneering techniques that would now seem strangely modern. His film noir scenarios were all variations on a single theme, the workings of the criminal mind. And his immoral protagonists typically masquerade behind respectable public images such as The Bat and its talkie sequel, The Bat Whispers. In Corsair, a college football hero quits a broker's firm after realizing he's preying on widows and orphans only to become a thuggish, manipulative run-runner. Through guile and brute violence, most of West's protagonists manage to evade punishment for their crimes. While performing in The Parade of the Criminal, in which he appeared for years on the vast Lowe's theater circuit, West met Joe Sneck, then Lowe's booking manager. West soon turned to producing and in 1912 directed his first film, Lost Souls, produced by Sneck. Sneck was born in Rybinsk, Russia on the Volga, Christmas Day, 1877. Came to New York at the age of 10. He and his younger brother Nicholas earned $4.50 a week as factory laborers. Soon became drugstore delivery boys in New York's Chinatown. And after years of hustling, Joe saved enough money to start a New Jersey amusement park with Nick as a partner. And Joe displayed his genius for show business. He parlayed the Jersey property into a larger one in the Bronx and sold that to Marcus Lowe, and along with brother Nick, went to work for him. Sneck left Lowe's in 1912 to launch a movie business with Roland West. 1917, he stole Fatty Arbuckle away from Keystone with a salary increase, an independent production deal, and the keys to a new roles. And like many of his deals to come, it was all done on a handshake. 1917, he took his company to California. By 1921, Sneck's man Arbuckle was the nation's second biggest box office draw, I can't talk. But over the Labor Day weekend, Arbuckle touched off the film industry's most infamous scandal. He was charged with the rape and murder of actress Virginia Rapp during a drunken orgy he hosted at a San Francisco hotel. The day that Fatty was arrested, Sneck pulled his latest film from distribution. Within days, cities across the country passed ordinances barring Arbuckle's films from theaters. When their friend, former Postmaster General Will Hayes, the Snecks created an industry watchdog agency and helped promulgate the infamous Morals Clause. Well, the Arbuckle scandal proved that Hollywood needed a place to play where moviegoers' disapproving eyes wouldn't see them. And this led Joe Sneck and a number of partners, including local vice lords and the very respectable Jacob Pauley, father of William S. Putley, or Paley, founder and chairman of CBS, to open an exclusive resort, complete with casinos, racetrack, hotel, and fine restaurants at Agua Caliente near Tijuana. As a major investor, Schneck was chairman of the board. And he became chairman of United Artists in 1924. 1933, he left to found 20th Century Productions, along with Louis B. Mayer's son-in-law, William Goetz, and Daryl Zanuck. Initial capital, $750,000, was put up by Mayer and by Nick Schneck, who was by then running Lowe's. 1935, 20th Century bought Fox, which was in bankruptcy, but controlled a huge chain of theaters. Schneck soon became one of California's wealthiest men with the vast real estate holdings in Arizona and California. For a time, he owned with Jacob Paley a Del Mar racetrack and a Lake Arrowhead resort. He controlled the Federal Trust and Savings Bank and was a major stockholder and director of the Bank of Italy, which is now the Bank of America. Became great friends with William Randolph Hearst. And at the time of Todd's death, he was already one of the most powerful men in the industry. His brother was the head of Lowe's and MGM, and therefore the boss of Hal Roach, the man who had made Todd a star. Well, there was a book called Fallen Angels, which chronicles 39 true stories of Los Angeles crime and mystery. There have been a lot of rumors, many of which were mentioned in the book, and Catherine Mader, who grew up in Pacific Palisades and has seen the times of the dies, kept pushing that this case be solved. There had to be somebody still alive in the era who knew what had actually happened. There was a screenwriter who, between family connections and writing projects, became something of an authority in old Hollywood. And he admitted he had heard whispers about Todd's killer, but he refused to go any further, saying he couldn't betray confidences. Instead, he referred investigators to a number of low-profile industry insiders. And for the most part, they either ducked down to questions or referred everybody cryptically to other people, most of whom, it turned out, were long dead. Even so, the one name that kept coming up again and again was Hal Roach. And at 90, the legendary comedy producer was still very much alive. Well, when he was called, he was ultimately accommodating and evasive. He was ill with a virus, and a few weeks later, he was too busy and he was out of town. Finally, he sat down and talked to some, I'm going to say investigators, I'm not talking about law enforcement. These were private investigators, I guess you could say. Well, Roach had a career that began in 1912, so he knew everybody who was in Hollywood. On December 17, 1935, the day after Todd's body was found, three L.A. County Sheriff's detectives came to Roach's office, and the deputies told Roach that Roland West, under intense questioning, confessed to killing Thelma Todd. Well, according to Roach, West was very possessive and very controlling. And Roach was actually the last survivor of the affair. He told Thelma she was to be back at 2. She said she'd come and go as she pleased. They had an argument about it. And when Thelma left for the party, when Sid Grauman called West about 2:30 to tell him West was leaving, West went to her apartment and locked her out. He's going to teach her a lesson. Well, apparently, Todd got back at about 4, and she declined her chauffeur's offer to walk her upstairs because she knew there'd be a scene with West. When she found the door locked, she shouted at him and they had another argument through the door. West told her he didn't want her going to many parties, and Todd was still a bit drunk and screamed at him she'd go to any party she wanted to. She's invited to another one that day at Ms. Wallace Ford, says she'd just go to that party now. According to Roach, she climbed the steps to the garage and West followed her. When he arrived, she was already in her car and she started the engine. He ran around and locked the garage door. He wasn't even thinking about carbon monoxide poisoning, but just about teaching her a lesson about who was the boss. So he left her in the car and went back to bed. When daylight returned, he went back to the garage and found her body. According to Roach, he didn't know what to do. So he did nothing, closed the door and didn't lock it, went back to the cafe. All that day, when people called for Thelma, he told them he didn't know where she was. And if he really hadn't, according to Roach, he'd have been calling over trying to find her. That's the kind of man he was. Well, The interesting thing is in this little getting it off his chest, besides naming the killer, Roach was actually admitted he took part in a cover-up. Sheriff's deputies had called on Roach. It turned out because they were sent there to seek his opinion on what they ought to do about West's confession. Roach said, "I told him he ought to forget about it. He wouldn't have gone to jail anyway because he had the best lawyers, and he denied everything in court, and there were no witnesses, so why cause everybody all this trouble?" Well, so not only was Hal Roach involved in the cover-up, but so was the law enforcement. Trio of deputy sheriffs raised more questions than it answered. Who sent them? Who did they report to after leaving Roach? And would Roach, in 1935, at the height of his influence, have had the clout to stop a police investigation? That's a very interesting question. Well, the first issue to consider is why Roach would have protected a man who killed his $3,000-a-week star. Of course, implicating West would have meant exposing Todd's adulterous affair, and that would have been a scandal like the Fatty Arbuckle affair. And it would have taken a hit in box office losses. The deputies left, and the case against West never surfaced. And Roach, frankly, wasn't such a powerful figure. Three deputies were simply to take his advice and quash a wrongful death investigation. And it was difficult to believe the deputies who had visited Roach could have made many decisions concerning a homicide case without consulting somebody higher up the food chain. So who sent the detectives to Roach in the first place? Well, whoever dispatched the deputies to talk to Roach would have had to work for the sheriff, and a few days spent prowling dusty stacks and unaccountable archives at the USC Library made it clear that Eugene Biscalas, who in 32 had resigned from the California Highway Patrol to win election as sheriff, was well acquainted with former Highway Commissioner Joe Snick, frequent visitor to Agua Caliente, and often photographed visiting film locations and studio sets with General Zanuck. Snick's partner with Mayor, whom Biscalas made an honorary deputy, Biscalas also knew Todd's best friend Zazu Pitts, a heavy contributor to his election campaign, in whose private car he had installed a police siren. And Biscalas also knew that Roland West was a 32nd-degree Mason and Lodge brother at the time when those associations meant a lot. And though it's rare, the Sheriff's Department can investigations of crimes committed within its boundaries. Biscalas chose to do so in 1935. His good friends with Deputy DA U.A. Blaylock, man who helped prepare and present the Todd case to the grand jury. As sheriff and a deeply rooted Angeleno, Biscalas had an institutional interest in the film business and financial health. And as for the LAPD, in 1935, Mayor Frank Shaw ruled Los Angeles like a private fiefdom. Police corruption was so pervasive, in 1937, Shaw was recalled from office. Dozens of senior officers fled to avoid prosecution. In 1935, anybody with money to spread around could have easily gotten to the LAPD Chief of Detectives, Thad Brown, who knew West had killed Todd. And Brown was told to back off because there was no evidence. So with all said and done, it's clear that Thelma Todd's death was actually a murder. And in fact, I'm going to finish a book about unsolved murders, and it's going to be thoroughly discussed. And the bottom line to this whole thing, it's like an issue I'm running into here in El Paso. We were defrauded by a roofing firm. And when I went to talk to the city about it, they said they take our inspectors out to lunch every day. We're not going to say a word about them. And if you'd open up your wallet and spread around some money, you wouldn't be having these issues. And I talked to another official who said, "Look, people like you have plenty of money. If you'd open up your wallet and spread it around, there'd be no issues whatsoever." And I said, "Who are people like me?" "You Jews." He said this with a perfectly serious, straight face. Well, on that note, we come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow and we'll talk about more unsolved mysteries. Till then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly Great evening.